Good afternoon. My name is Stephanie, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the What's in the Water conference call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you. I would now like to turn the call over to Carol Gregory with the Conservation Law Foundation. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much, Stephanie. My name is Carol Gregory, and I'm the Interim Director of CLF in Massachusetts. And thank you so much for joining us for this important conversation, for our friends and supporters who are on the phones, and also for those of you who are joining us live on Facebook. Water is something that is a critical issue for all of us. Something we all need to survive, so it's a very important topic. And with us today are the advocates that are on the front lines of our clean water work. We have Brad Campbell, who is the president of CLF, and we have Jeff Barnum, our Great Bay Piscataqua waterkeeper, who's here from New Hampshire, and also he works in Maine. And then on the phone today, we have Rebecca Weber, who is our Lake Champlain lakekeeper. So thank you all for being here today. So I think, Brad, let's just start and kick this conversation off with you and talk about our water work has been a major part of CLF's work, and just give us a bit of a snapshot of that, the work that we've done and what we're doing.
Well, CLF really cut its teeth on clean water litigation, beginning with the effort to clean up Boston Harbor, which spanned 20 years, but turned the harbor into essentially an open sewer, into a focus of recreation and beauty for all of the region to enjoy. We have some different battles today, and really we're in the midst of a perfect storm of four different influences that make our work a little bit more challenging, and put public health and the environment at greater risk. And those factors are, first, the Trump factor, the most recent one, where the president in less than a few weeks has already invalidated a major rule that would have prevented the dumping of mining waste in streams. He's reopened federal lands to lead ammunition, lead shot, that contributes to lead contamination of sediments. And he's floated a cut in EPA's resources of anywhere from a third to a quarter, both in staffing and in funding. The second factor is that those cuts now proposed by Trump would be on top of sustained cuts in environmental funding at the state level. The state agencies across the state, and certainly true in New England, are on average about a third smaller than they were 10 or 15 years ago as a result of retirements and as a result of tight budgets preventing backfill and replacement of those employees. And so the environmental cop that we historically have expected to be on the beat, chasing polluters and enforcing against violations, simply isn't there. The third factor is really the march of science. We have an increasing ability to detect clean water threats. There is an increasing body of science linking specific water pollutants to deadly diseases. And our agencies, because they are understaffed, simply haven't kept up with the pace of science in terms of bringing this greater understanding of threats to public health and the environment into their work in controlling water pollution. And of course, the most significant factor on top of these is climate change. Here in the Northeast, we've already experienced, as a result of climate change, a roughly 70% increase in intense storm events, where we get an inch or two of or more of rain in a 24-hour period. That means that our infrastructure is overwhelmed. And so the basic infrastructure that we use to control pollution coming into our waters from stormwater runoff is overwhelmed. And those four factors together present new challenges for CLF and really an expanded scope of work for us in protecting clean water throughout New England. And one of the symptoms of that greater challenge is the blue-green algae blooms that we're seeing throughout our waters from Connecticut through Vermont and Maine. And Rebecca Weber, our Lake Champlain waterkeeper, who's joining us today. Rebecca, I'm wondering if you want to highlight some of the ways in which the additional pollution on Lake Champlain is affecting your work and what we're doing about it.
Sure. So, and that's a great point also to make, just that what I talk about today with Lake Champlain is happening all across New England and really around the world, which is just having too much nutrients in our waterways. And that's leading to these toxic blue-green algae blooms. And, you know, hitting on that point of science earlier that Brad had mentioned, you know, there's new studies that are coming out that are linking these blue-green algae blooms with neurological diseases, ALS, and we're seeing a lot of beach closures. We're seeing decrease in tourism. We're seeing lowered property values. So there's a whole host of reasons why we need to clean up our waterways and make sure that we're not exposing ourselves to these toxic blooms. So here in Vermont, what that means is we've been successful this past year in coming up with a budget, if you will, or limits on how much nutrient pollution can enter into the lake to be on a 20-year time frame to get to a point where, and hopefully we'll see progress much earlier than this, but in 20 years we'll have a clean Lake Champlain and no more blooms.
Well, one of the challenges, of course, is funding, and thanks to Rebecca's work, when I met last week with incoming governor, new governor, Scott of Vermont, he reaffirmed his commitment to full funding of the plan that Rebecca and our Vermont office helped put in place through years and years of litigation. But the issue is not limited to Vermont, obviously. And Jeff, you're in New Hampshire and Maine. Give us a sense of how it's affecting Great Piscataway Bay and communities there.
Sure, Brad. CLF has had a real significant and positive presence, you know, on Seacoast, New Hampshire, Southern Maine, Great Bay Estuary, Piscataquis River in the last 5 years. Nitrogen pollution, which comes from wastewater treatment plants, has been degrading the Great Bay Estuary, which is an estuary of national significance. And what CLF has done in the last few years through some real strong advocacy and through intervention in the courts, it has now arrived at a place where all of the seven major wastewater treatment plants that discharge into the estuary are in a queue. They're either in compliance, they're currently upgrading, and three out of those seven are going to be built totally new. And all of them will have the ability to decrease the amount of nitrogen that's having a profound effect on eelgrass, which is the basis of that entire ecosystem. With those wastewater treatment plants in a queue, we obviously have to give those nitrogen reductions to time to see what happens with respect to how quickly this estuary rebounds. And it's not like hitting a light switch. We've got to give it time. We've got to stay the course with these reductions and see what happens. My focus recently has shifted more towards stormwater. As you know, stormwater, when it rains or the snow melts, everything it picks up is going to end up at the bottom of the pipe. You know, so we're talking about nitrogen from fertilizers. We're also talking about hydrocarbons. We're talking about suspended solids. Everything that the rain picks up is going to end up in our bodies of water.
And just to jump in there for a second, Jeff.
Sure, go ahead.
Also, not just the pollutants that we're worried about, but it's also the velocity. So one of the issues when water hits pavement, you know, roads, parking lots, rooftops, instead of infiltrating directly into the ground, going through soils, what happens is it's picking up speed, and that's causing greater erosion, increased flood risk. So it's a combination of not only quantity but also quality. So just to add that in there.
And Brad, I think it'd be interesting for you to talk about some of the work that we've done, because we've done some pretty groundbreaking work in addressing stormwater pollution. Can you talk about that with the Charles River?
We have lawsuits pending on the Charles River in Rhode Island for a number of water bodies where we are essentially asking EPA or asking the courts to force EPA to do its job. In many of these water bodies, EPA has already done very good science saying these are the sources of the pollution that need to be regulated if we're going to restore this body of water to health. And that's true for the Charles, true for Mashpog Pond in Rhode Island, Narragansett Bay. But they've never followed through and actually imposed water pollution limits on those facilities. And what should be really a community effort to address water pollution becomes really a fight in court to get EPA to do its job, or at least find a solution if it's not going to be one that directly is a direct regulatory approach. CLF had great experience in Long Pond in Maine in bringing together, although we had to file lawsuits there too, we ultimately were able to bring together the stakeholders, whether they were mall owners or other sources of pollution running off the pavement, into a solution for that body of water. And we need more of that collaborative work, but it only begins when people see they have the obligation to stop their water pollution.
I'd really like to talk, as you mentioned, the community, because a lot of the work that CLF is doing, we really rely on input and engagement from community and residents. Rebecca, perhaps you can talk a little bit about what's been going on in Vermont and how you've been engaging people, and what are people saying right now, and what are they looking for from your new governor, Governor Scott?
Sure. So I should say that, you know, first off, Vermonters, you know, Lake Champlain is our crown jewel. Vermonters are engaged. They are learning about the issues. You know, about 200,000 people in Vermont get their drinking water from Lake Champlain. So what I'm doing really is going into communities and talking to people and making sure that their voice is then heard at our state house. So connecting local communities across Vermont really to their representatives. And so that takes place by either, you know, physically asking them to come to a specific meeting at the state house and have their voices heard, or for them to echo what I'm lobbying for and have them call in an email. So really the most important thing that I'm doing right now is providing information to Vermonters, and a great way of doing that is through our news alerts, so people can sign up through CLF, and then they'll learn about different opportunities that they might have to engage in the process.
The impact of Rebecca's work is, I think, reflected in the fact that when I met with Governor Scott last week, his staff was able to rattle off how the numbers in attendance at watershed meetings were increasing across the state. And it shows how much impact that engagement can have. People are, I think, for those iconic waters like Great Piscataway Bay, like Lake Champlain, they're able to see the impact. But we're also focused at CLF on waters that have been neglected and don't get that kind of attention. Our lawsuit against ExxonMobil, for example, is typical of the work, because that's a facility where the increase in rain intensity has overwhelmed their treatment system, meaning that both the Mystic River and the communities that have hosted that facility are facing discharges of potent carcinogens at levels thousands and in some cases tens of thousands of times greater than the EPA, than the limits EPA set to protect public health. But it's also, I think, important to understand we tend to get involved in parts per million and parts per trillion quite a bit, but it's also an impact on the pastimes that make New England such an important place for those of us here at CLF and those of us on the phone. And Jeff, as a longtime New Englander, I'm wondering if the link to this nutrient pollution and how what people can even do on the day.
I think that all of us have a tendency to take clean water for granted, but the bottom line is there's really no guarantee, and we need to be the protectors of the water in our backyard, because if we're not going to do it, nobody else is. No one's going to do it for us. So we as a society need to be paying more attention to the problems that our local waters have. And we do have the ability, and I've seen it happen, we have the ability locally to improve the quality of our waters, irrespective of what happens with the regulators in the at the state level or the EPA.
Can you go oystering on Great on the bay today?
When I was a lot younger and grew up in southern New Hampshire, my dad always promised me that he would take me oystering in Great Bay because that was the place to go. Everybody had been going there actually for centuries to harvest oysters. In the early 90s, we had 1,100 acres, and almost overnight, we lost 1,000 acres, and we lost the ability of oysters to filter water. And there were other events that have happened since that have further degraded that ecosystem. I've seen, you know, we no longer have rainbow smelt. They were just as iconic as oysters. Everybody in the springtime put a shanty up on Great Bay. Great Bay seldom freezes anymore. No one's smelting. The smelt have pretty much left. We see some bird, some waterfowl that no longer stop in Great Bay. On the other side of that coin, we're starting to see blue crabs from the Chesapeake. Don't ask me how far they're traveling in order to get here, but they're there in the summertime. We see black sea bass. We never had black sea bass. So there are some profound changes that are already here.
And it's important to note that that has a profound impact on the economy as well. One of the huge reasons, you know, that the business community has really jumped on board in terms of asking for funding for clean waters, they've recognized that Lake Champlain, you know, tourism in Vermont is a $2.5 billion industry, and a lot of that has to do with clean water and having a clean Lake Champlain. So a lot of these species that Jeff is going on, it's not just biodiversity, but it's also our economy.
I just want to remind people quickly if you have questions, please hit star one to get in line, because we want this to be a conversation. We really want to hear from you. And for those of you who have joined us on Facebook, please type those questions in. This is an important topic, and it's very important to hear what you're thinking and your ideas.
And Rebecca's point about the linkage to the economy, I think, is really important. When CLF brought litigation to compel EPA to address the nutrient loading and the algae blooms and brown scum that were affecting the bays of Cape Cod, one of the things that really moved EPA to resolve that litigation with us was the fact that the business community, because tourism is such a big part of the economy of the Cape, the business community woke up and said, this is a problem that has to be addressed. And I think that's critically important. But there are also less visible threats to our water quality, and especially our drinking water, in the sense that not that far away from where we were addressing the Cape water problems, there's Barnstable groundwater contamination with a new contaminant. It's not regulated by EPA. It's not directly regulated by most states, and it's showing up in drinking water throughout New England, from Bennington and North Bennington, Vermont, to Barnstable in Massachusetts. And is even closing down wells western Massachusetts and other states. And Jeff, you've been on the ground actually doing water testing. How is this popping up in New Hampshire?
Well, it's a pretty serious threat to drinking water, and I contend also to surface water. But these PFCs that Brad's talking about, these are perfluorinated chemicals. They are manufactured chemicals. They are persistent organic compounds. They stay in the environment. They don't leave your system. They do bioaccumulate. They're not found in nature. So we know that whenever we do find them, that they're coming from something. And they are used or were used in the manufacture of Teflon fry pans. They're used in Gore-Tex clothing. They're used in carpet treatments. But in my area, their predominant use was in the firefighting foams that you would find at Air Force bases. We have an Air Force base that was decommissioned in the early 90s. So here we are 26 years later, and we have this contamination which has caused the shutdown of municipal wells at the Pease Air Force Base. The waste from Pease Air Force Base went to another site that also became eventually a Superfund site, and it's a Coakley landfill. And CLF decided that because the federal government and the state wasn't testing the surface waters that we ought to. And so we did. And to our surprise, we found some elevated numbers. And that was disturbing. But what it did do was it caused the state and the EPA to undertake some more serious and widespread water testing in both drinking water wells and in surface waters. So CLF really initiated and sort of lit a firecracker under the regulators to pay a little bit closer attention. So that's been real positive. The other thing that's come out of that, Brad, is that there was a motivated representative in state government, Mindy Mesmer, who actually introduced some bills into the legislature, and with support and help from CLF, they're moving through the legislative process, and in the end, I'm hoping that we're going to have more protective standards, you know, at the state level. Very similar to what Vermont or New Jersey has when it comes to PFCs in drinking water. The surface water standards are way down the road, and we're not going to see the EPA or the state of New Hampshire coming up with any surface water standards, but it is an issue that's being addressed in states like Michigan and Minnesota, and we need to address it here too.
And there's a real debate about what the standards need to be, and so it can be confusing to the public if these compounds show up in your drinking water. Well, how safe, how clean, how safe is safe? And right now we have Vermont imposing a standard, imposing one standard, which in that case we think is protective. But EPA and Massachusetts are using a standard that's more than three times the Vermont standard, which we think is not adequately protective. So we're fighting both an effort to get these agencies to clean up, to make sure it's not entering drinking water at the tap, but also an effort to flag for them the science that shows what the protective level should be, so that not only the environment but public health is protected.
We actually just looking, we have a related question on Facebook from Joan. What is to stop each state making up their own regulations with regards to water quality?
States actually can set water quality standards and can set them to be more strict than the federal standards. For example, the drinking water standard I mentioned that Vermont is currently defending against an industry challenge less than a third of what EPA is using as a standard for PFCs in drinking water. And there are targeted areas where state water quality standards need to be more stringent, but we're often facing the problem that the standards that are on the books aren't being adequately enforced. And so the work on Lake Champlain, we know what the right water quality standards should be, how to get there when many of these stormwater sources of nutrients and other pollutants are are just not yet regulated. And so that's where we're pushing, is to make sure those unregulated sources of pollution get addressed, whether it's through regulation and permitting or whether it's through innovative and collaborative approaches. And just to give those on the phone and on Facebook a sense of scale, more oil enters U.S. waters every year, several times more, through stormwater than was spilled in the massive Exxon Valdez oil spill in Prince William Sound. And so it is these recurring and constant releases, as Rebecca said, from the increased velocity of stormwater that are really making it harder and harder to get to fishable and swimmable waters in New England.
Well, with that question, related question coming into Facebook, I'd really think it'd be a good time to start opening up our lines and hearing from people, their concerns and their questions. If you have not already done so, to get into line, if you're on the phone, please press *1 to get in the queue. And if you're on Facebook, please just type in your question and let us know what your concerns are, what you're doing in your neighborhoods and your communities. First question is coming from Sharon.
Are you there?
Yes.
My question is related to the Trump administration at this point and Scott Pruitt with their attack on the Clean Water Act. And we are in the process, I'm in Harwich, Massachusetts, we're in the process of implementing our CWNP, and we're going to be going to our town meeting asking for quite a large sum of money. And some of the questions have come back to me in regards to the feeling that, do we really need to keep going forward with this CWNP in light of the fact that the Trump administration and Scott Pruitt are not in favor of the Clean Water Act? But how would you suggest we respond to people that want to hold off moving forward? And on dovetail to that is the question, which you might have already answered, in regards to the fact that the states can still dictate or require you to clean up the water, and is that still going to be true?
So I just want to highlight that the CWMP is a watershed management plan that is intended to address many of these sources of pollution. And it is absolutely the case that those sources of pollution will need to be addressed even if the Trump administration cuts back enforcement. We think we're very bullish that attacks on the Clean Water Act will be stopped. There are some specific rules we think Trump may succeed in reversing, but the types of plans that you're working on are plans that are going to be enforced at the state level if they're not enforced at the federal level, and they'll be enforced through lawsuits from CLF if neither the state or the federal government pursues them. I'm sorry?
Just to add, we have similar questions up here in Vermont that I hear all the time. We don't have the, we don't have the same planning mechanism, but ours, the acronym being a TMDL, but the limits that we have, and what I keep saying is, this is a contract between, basically the state of Vermont and the people of Vermont saying that we're going to get to clean water. And that can be upheld in court regardless of what happens to EPA. So, this is certainly questions that are coming throughout New England.
And, there are, I don't know what the elements of the plan proposed are, but, these, as was mentioned, these are pollution sources that have a direct impact to public health. The blue-green algae that's produced when stormwater is in control, for example, produces a neurotoxin that's linked to Alzheimer's, Parkinson's disease, ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease. And so really, I think the argument isn't about, regardless of whatever Trump decides to do with the Clean Water Act, families and businesses want their health protected, want their economy protected. And I think that's the strongest brief you have for the doubters who say, well, let's just wait and see if Trump rolls back the Clean Water Act.
Sharon, go ahead.
Thanks, Carol. Mm-hmm. Sharon, I would just simply add that while the federal government can cut off a funding stream that would be beneficial for you, they can't stop you from protecting local waters. And I don't think for a second that you should not act because of some changes at the EPA. I mean, it's your local waters are yours to protect, and you need to do that.
Great. Well, let me just ask one further question to that. In response to somebody that then says, you know, if we don't have the federal government mandating, you know, through the state to clean up the water, are we correct in responding back to them in saying that although maybe the federal government backs off, that the states can still mandate and probably will mandate cleaning up the cleaning up our waters? Are we correct?
Absolutely, that's the case. In our state, one of the regulatory requirements we're now defending in court are the municipal stormwater permits that have been approved by EPA, most recently in Massachusetts and New Hampshire. And those mandates, we believe, will stay in place, and we're in court making sure they stay in place. But at the end of the day, communities also need to recognize that this is a matter of protecting public health. It's a matter of protecting their communities from flooding, as we've seen in some of the intense storm events where communities have been flooded because their infrastructure has been overwhelmed. And we think the focus should be on public health and not driven solely by mandates from the federal government, which we,
okay,
for the most part, we expect will stay in place.
Thank you very much. Those are some great questions. I really appreciate those. Let's go back to Facebook now. Amanda Evanson, what is the single most effective thing a citizen can do right now to help protect our water? And remind me, I'm not going to do last names just to make sure I don't mispronounce anything. So, Amanda, thank you.
Thank you for your question, Amanda. I think that our water keepers who are on the front lines of this, I'm going to ask Rebecca to chime in, and then I'm going to follow up.
Sure. So I would say the single most important thing you can do is stay engaged. Certainly you can to learn about the issues. CLF has some great blogs that we put out to give context to these issues, and then signing up for our e-news, you can keep abreast of what specific moments in time where you can lend your voice and add your two cents to the issue. So really it's about knowing about the issues and then, you know, speaking to your representatives about them. So those are sort of the two most important things that I would say you can do, and to sort of help you along, you know, we're more than welcome. We welcome new members. We welcome new activists. So, you know, we certainly want to hear from Vermonters and all New Englanders and add your voice to ours.
And, you know, it can be awfully frustrating and daunting to try to keep abreast, especially with all of the terrible proposals we're seeing coming out of the Trump administration of how and when to weigh in and what's most effective. But that's really part of CLF's job is to arm you with the tools you need, and so when you sign up for our action alerts, we flag for you where the opportunities are to weigh in specifically. You know, which member needs to be contacted, or which state is this bad bill moving most quickly? Where is the community meeting where you can express your support for clean water or raise questions about your drinking water safety? So that's part of our job, and that's why we encourage people to engage by signing up for our alerts and also to engage their networks with us, to bring your – obviously, the mere fact that you're on the phone means that all of you have a fundamental concern about this issue. We need you to bring to the table folks who, as Jeff said, just take clean water for granted and assume what's coming from the tap is always safe. Enormously important. And of course, we hope that you will support CLF. All of these efforts we're mentioning require resources. We're going to have to bring a lot more enforcement actions and a lot more lawsuits and other actions to essentially fill in the gap that's left as EPA is weakened under the Trump administration and states are doing significantly less in the way of enforcement. Here in Massachusetts, front page of the Boston Globe today, the state environmental agency has been cut by nearly a third, and enforcement actions have gone down by nearly a third. So as long as that is continuing to be the case and there isn't any significant new funding available in the governor's current budget, we're going to be fighting a rearguard action to make sure the law is enforced and lawbreakers are held accountable.
I want to make sure we're getting to all of the people that we have lined up here now, so if we could just go to the phones. David, you have a question?
Yes, I have a concern about contaminants or emerging concern in the drinking water here in Cape Cod. And I wanted to get some suggestions and effective outreach endeavors. I've been working with the Silent Spring Institute, who studies these problems, and also on April 22nd, we were going to do outreach at a local church. But I was wondering, a lot of people aren't aware of the PFOS and PFOA problems we have and other toxic chemical problems in our drinking water, and so we need to spread the word so people can put some pressure on their political leaders and policymakers to do something.
Are you in Barnstable County?
I am.
Well, CLF actually was just meeting with the Department of Environmental. I met 2 weeks ago with the commissioner of the Department of Environmental Protection, really urging them to be more aggressive in the cleanup that needs to take place there. And actually, there's a homegrown New England company that has the technologies available to clean up that site, which is for the rest of you on the phone, is the Barnstable Fire Training Academy. And as Jeff said, where they used firefighting foams extensively, and it has contaminated the groundwater. We are also asking DEP to follow the more stringent standards that states like Vermont have adopted. So we're very much on the case, but honestly, I think in Massachusetts alone, there are seven drinking water systems where this is a serious issue, and we're on the ground trying to make folks more aware of it. Unfortunately, I think that locally, the issue has been more of a debate between the county and others about who pays for the cleanup. We need to really focus on removing the sources of those PFCs in addition to making sure the water at the end of the tap is safe.
And just to speak more broadly about engaging the public and spreading the word, I mean, that's sort of what Jeff and I do on a regular basis. You know, some of the things that I've found to be most effective are, you know, first of all, social media, Twitter, Facebook, really using your own networks and then inviting your friends to also extend the word out, you know, even further. Also thinking about what local groups are already meeting. Here in Vermont, we have conservation commissions, and they, you know, meet once a month. You know, each municipality, each town generally has one to talk about environmental issues. And so I just, you know, put out a flyer and said, hey, can I come and sit down and talk about issues that I've been focusing on? And so sort of tapping into infrastructure that's already in existence to spread the word out further. So those are just a couple of ideas.
And we will I'm sorry.
I would add to that and say that I mean, I give a fair amount, a fair number of presentations around the Great Bay watershed, where there's 52 towns. And what I find out is that people, and I don't mean this in a derogatory way, but most people are ignorant. They don't know where their watershed is. They don't know where their stormwater goes. And I find that often if a body of water isn't on fire or has an oil slick on it, most people think that it's okay. And they just simply don't have the interest or the time to dig deeper and find out what is the status of my local waters. So that's Rebecca's job, that's my job, it's CLF's job to educate people. But the people that we educate need to educate other folks. They need to ask the really hard questions of their conservation commissions and their planning boards. The question has to be, is my town doing everything it can to reduce stormwater pollution? That's where those changes are going to occur. I'm convinced of that, and that's what needs to happen.
Thank you. Let's go again to the phones we have, or do we have anybody on Facebook? Okay, let's go to Facebook then. From Sarah, how would this threat to water quality be affected by the growing impacts of climate change? Great question.
Well, that's a great question. As I mentioned, you know, one of the climate change impacts that's already here is a more than 70% increase in intense rain events. And that has so many different negative impacts for New Englanders. One, as Rebecca pointed out, you get increased velocity of water going through the system. That means it picks up and holds more pollutants that wind up being carried into our waterways and into our drinking water sources. A second impact is that all that water moves through the system much more quickly. So you actually lose, even though you have more volume of water, you lose groundwater because there isn't as much time for the water to infiltrate down to groundwater. So you have this somewhat counterintuitive system where the more intense and higher volume rains are actually starving our groundwater of replenishment. And you also have this issue, because that water moves through the system so quickly, you then get lower stream flows, especially at the warmer months of the year, the hotter months of the year, and that actually adds to this problem of the blue-green algae outbreaks that have shut down beaches and created a very potent public health hazard.
Thank you. Let's go back to the phones. Reed, what is your question? Reed, are you still there?
While we're waiting for Reed, I just want to add to that climate change question, because two things I didn't note are, one, because we also have warming, that also, obviously, the temperature warming is also adding to these blue-green algae outbreaks, because it's raising the temperature of the water, creating more thermal pollution. And one that doesn't often get mentioned is these pollutants, these nutrients, actually exacerbate the impact of climate on the oceans. When we have a lot of these nutrients coming into our coastal areas, where we have shellfish beds, ocean acidification linked to climate change is increasingly interfering with the ability of shellfish to form their shells. And when you get a nutrient load, the science shows that impact is made even worse. And so those are other dimensions of the climate change problem.
So, Reed, do we have you, or do we lose you, Reed? Okay, let's go to...
Hi.
This is Rick.
I'm Rick. Yeah.
Okay, Rick. Okay. Sorry about that, Rick.
That's all right. Can you talk more about the Long Pond, Maine effort that you did, where you engaged the community in a discussion about what you could do about all the sources? Was that a TMDL that you did there?
That resulted from our litigation to our lawsuit to bring about a TMDL and to have EPA actually enforce the TMDL by permitting sources. And rather than, and for us at CLF, getting a permitting system or imposing permit requirements, that's not the end point for us, because you can always get a lousy permitting system. What we really are focused on, and one of the things that attracted me to CLF, is we're a very solution-oriented organization. So if there's another way to get to the solution without the bureaucratic process of permitting, we're open to that. And that was really the dialogue that was opened up among stakeholders on Long Pond. And it was driven by the TMDL, because the TMDL provided the science we needed to say, which were the sources, which were the significant sources of loading to the water body, and, you know, and where we needed, where the smart places were to make the reductions. But the science needed to be implemented, and there it drove, instead of driving us toward a permitting solution, it drove us toward a really good dialogue with the stakeholders, and that's what we'd like to replicate and are in the process of replicating on Lake Champlain, and that we'd like to see more broadly throughout all our watersheds.
Are you going to be writing guidance?
I'm sorry?
Are you going to produce guidance for communities on doing what you just said?
Well, we're happy to provide guidance for communities that reach out to us. Usually there's it's often a very specific, water body specific set of issues. So the issue may be much different in a rural area where, you know, dairy pastures are the source of much of the loading compared to a more urban area where it may be the wastewater treatment plant that is the source. But Jeff, do you want to weigh in on sort of some of the community approaches we've undertaken?
Well, I was thinking about actually with respect to coastal resiliency, you know, as sea level rises, there's going to be impacts to communities. Some of that is obviously infrastructure that's town owned or city owned. But I was thinking about septic systems actually. You know, there needs to be a certain elevation between groundwater, normal groundwater level, and the bottom of your septic field. And that's going to change over time as sea level does rise. And those septic systems are no longer going to be efficient as they should be. Now, CLF spent the time to develop this white paper that was really well done. And I've made the effort to get it to the regional planning commissions, you know, around Great Bay that are working on coastal resiliency issues, you know, with a number of communities. And it's been positively received, and I'm hoping that planning boards are going to take into consideration when they decide which areas of town should be developed, which should not, given sea level rise.
And if you want to email me, and you can just email me at president@clf.org, we can help get you guidance that's appropriate for your watershed.
Okay, great. Let's go to back on the lines. And thank you, Rick, and sorry about that for your name. Let's go to Julian, if that's your name, Julian.
This is Jillian Davies, and I'm president of the International Society of Wetland Scientists, and thanks to CLF for doing this great conference call. Something that I would encourage people to do is to contact your legislators in support of Obama's 2015 Clean Water Rule. As you may recall, President Trump issued an executive order on February 28th directing EPA and the Corps of Engineers to review, revise, and I think in their hopes, revoke that Clean Water Rule that was based on over 1,000 peer-review research papers and is really soundly rooted in science. And if you would like additional information on that, if you just Google Society of Wetland Scientists and look in our news section, you will find links to our letter in support of the Obama Clean Water Rule that was co-signed by 6 other aquatic science societies and biological science societies, as well as a link to an amicus brief written by a number of very well-known wetland scientists and attorneys that was submitted to the Supreme Court in this court case. So those are some resources people could have.
Yeah, this is, thank you for that comment and for those resources and for your fight. I mean, this is very typical. This is the known generally as the waters of the U.S. rule. And it's significant because it really defines which wetlands are protected under the law from being filled without a permit, and wetlands that are unprotected and essentially can be filled willy-nilly, depending on which state you're in and whether your state has a program more protective than the federal program. It raises a broader issue for us, which is the need across the board to be defending science in environmental protection, in public health protection. This is a leading example, but unfortunately the only example where we're seeing science under siege, and certainly that's the case in the Trump administration, where the Environmental Protection Agency, which has been among the lead agencies on climate science, is now being led by a climate denier who has sued to stop rules to address climate pollution, and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, which has also been a critical player in the science of climate change, is also having its climate program whittled back substantially. And legislators need to hear that these are issues that are important to their constituents. And those of us in progressive states, like most of the states of New England, also need to weigh in with our family and networks that are in less progressive places, helping them to understand why environmental protection is important. But just to give you an example, there is in January, legislation was passed again by the House of Representatives that would essentially prohibit any rule from taking effect by any agency unless Congress affirmatively approved the rule, any major rule. And we, you know, although most of the New England delegation voted against it, we did have a vote from a Maine representative in favor of it. And that type of rule, and they even voted down exemptions for veterans' health and children's safety, that type of legislative initiative goes under the radar screen. Probably most people on the phone have never heard of it. But it could threaten to shut down and roll back years of progress on environmental protection and any effort to bring our laws and our regulations up to date with what we're learning through science.
We're rounding up to the hour, and I just want to thank everyone who participated today and for your questions and your thoughtful comments. I think we need to wrap this up now, and I encourage you to join us for future teleconferences. We're doing these on a bi-monthly basis, and we also welcome your ideas for topics. This was clearly one that people are very engaged in. Any final thoughts, Brad?
Yeah, I just want to add my thanks to all of you who took the time to listen in. Well, we hope it's valuable, and we welcome any input on how we can be better at delivering up-to-date information to you. But I also want to end on a note of hope. It's very easy to hear these various threats to public health and the environment, to hear some of the unfortunate things that are being done in Washington, and think that all is lost. But if there's one thing that CLF learned and really made part of its DNA in fighting for the Boston Harbor cleanup, is that we can take on big battles and win. We could do that when we have the support of engagement of a broad range of members. And I appreciate all of you who are supporting CLF. And I encourage those of you who may be new to CLF or who may have friends or family who don't know of CLF to join us to broaden our membership to all of your networks so that we can carry on this work, which, as this discussion makes clear, is going to be hard and very resource-intensive over the next several years. But thank you for your commitment to these issues and your support for CLF.
Thank you. This concludes today's conference. You may now disconnect. Speakers hold the line.